You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, where we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. Now, this podcast is all about the future of retail, which, let's face it, is a pretty big topic right now. The last 10 weeks of lockdown has fundamentally changed the way retail works. Where does that leave the food industry? The big questions are, how much of this change will or should remain or continue or develop further? The food industry is constantly evolving anyway. Is this recent change really any different to the incremental changes that inevitably happen? What significance is there for both the shops and the entire supply chain? Well, here to answer all of these questions, we have Mike Watkins, Head of Retailer and Business Insight at Nielsen.
Hello.
Sam Roscoe, Senior Lecturer in Operations Management at the University of Sussex.
Hello.
And Shane Brennan, Chief Executive at the Cold Chain Federation.
Hello.
Now, Shane, what would you say are the most significant changes in retail that you've seen?
I think, well, Cold Chain Federation is a supply chain business, so we see it from that perspective. And I think the biggest thing about the COVID-19 period has been the fact that we've been flying blind. We're so used to operating in a world of forecasts, where retailers are able to forecast with some degree of experience and knowledge of the past around what's coming up in the days and weeks ahead. COVID-19 has seen that go because of the completely unprecedented nature of the retail patterns that we've seen, with panic buying like we've never seen before at the very beginning of the crisis, through to a period of strange alternative reality where parts of the sector have seen some significant demand, others have seen none, and it's been relatively unpredictable through that time, certainly at first. We've established some patterns, but as soon as those patterns seem to establish, we then see another change, and that's what we're all sort of waiting for, the next sort of dip in the roller coaster.
So predictability, forecasting, and basically planning for a really complex sort of, I mean, this is a concatenation. It's a chain, isn't it? So if one link is delayed or screwed up, then it affects everything. Sam, would you agree? You look at operations management and supply chains as well. How does this unfold? What have been the practical ramifications of changes?
Yeah, I think that point about predictability is really interesting. And if you think about the supply chain for the food supply chain, is really based on what's termed a lean or just-in-time delivery methodology. And the idea behind that is the food comes in, it's packaged, and it's delivered ideally onto store shelves as quickly as possible. And now that model, that lean model, is based on predictable demand. And when you have a crisis such as this that hits, we don't know what to expect. And that takes a while then for the just-in-time model to be able to respond to that. So what we've seen since March up until today, the beginning of June, is you've seen empty shelves to those shelves, then over the past, I would say, month and a half, have actually been filled up again. And we're getting back to business as normal as the supply chain has begun to adapt and respond to that initial shock. And I think we're now in more of a stable territory as we're adjusting to, you know, people staying home and eating at home and having that that move away from the restaurant sector to more eating at home.
So would you say then, Sam, that the just-in-time model for the supply chain is essentially, in the light of this, unworkable, outdated, not really fit for purpose?
No, I wouldn't say that. And I think we have to be aware, obviously, the lean just-in-time model is geared around keeping your costs low, keeping your inventory holdings low, and trying to have this cost minimization approach, which in 98-99% of the time works perfectly well, and it makes sure that your margins are optimized. But when you do have a pandemic like this, and one that's hit the entire globe incredibly hard, it does take time for the supply chain model to adapt. Now, there are other things that businesses now know that they'll have to do, such as possibly having more inventory holding, more local sourcing, having UK sourcing for other types of fresh fruit and vegetables where possible. So a lot of different things can begin to change as, you know, as these issues have been exposed early on in the pandemic.
Yeah. Okay. So Mike, we've heard from the supply chain. What about the retailers? You know, what have they seen changing, and what is the consumer doing that's different? And is it workable? Is it workable in the long term?
So, building upon what we've just heard, absolutely, we've just seen what I've called a seismic shift in shopping behavior. And I've been in the industry 25, 30 years. I've never seen anything like this before. We've had two things which happened at the same time. We've had unpredictable demand since early March, and we've had significant supply constraints. So a bit of a perfect storm, if you like. If you give you the context of what shoppers did in terms of food and drink, the sales in the middle of March, as shoppers started to prepare for what was known as lockdown, we saw growth peaking at 30-35% for 2 or 3 weeks. That was bigger than Christmas. That was totally unexpected. And that's when we did have out of stock availability, supply chain shortages. The supply chain just in time just could not cope. It was unpredicted. And then early in April, when shoppers were in lockdown, we stopped shopping. Sales fell 12% 1 week and fell 16% 2 weeks later. Again, totally unpredictable. No algorithm, no human being could have actually predicted that. And then since early May, as we are in lockdown, as we slowly start to exit, we've returned to weekly sales growth across the supermarkets between 5-10%, which are a little bit more stable, but even those peaks are bigger than what we normally see in December. So, you know, there's absolutely, it's been impossible to track what the consumer's going to do next. And, you know, this, it's a great testament to the food and drink industry, the whole industry, that we've been able to feed the nation as we have very, very successfully with such unbelievably different and dramatic consumer behavior shifts.
Yeah. And would you say that the one fundamental shift in consumers for consumers has been their transference to online shopping? Is that the most impactful?
It's one of the most impactful. There have actually been five things that have happened over the last 8 weeks. As we enter lockdown, we saw lots of shopping trips, much, much bigger baskets as shoppers stocked up in anticipation of lockdown. As we have been in lockdown, we've seen fewer visits as shoppers had to plan what they've done. And that's when we started to see the shift to spend to online, which actually has doubled over the 8 weeks from what was 7% of all channel sales of food and drink in the UK to over 13% in May. And the third thing we see is, I think probably come on to that, is shoppers have been shopping more locally. It's not been talked about. I think we should probably come to that in a few minutes' time. But we're starting to see what people buy is different. And of course, with the limited ability to travel, to go to work, and no ability to consume out of home, we found that eating at home has been the new norm, and that in itself has changed what we buy within ambient, frozen and fresh categories. And last but not least, we've seen a new demand for food delivery, which is another new trend that wasn't really significant before. So overall, we've seen supply chain having to cope with how we shop, what we buy, and of course, where we buy it.
So Shane, with all of these changes, does this mean that there's a fractured or even fractious relationship between manufacturers and retailers? You know, getting that food from field to mouth, that it's going through entirely different channels now. That must be extraordinarily disruptive.
Well, I think the one thing that you can say about this crisis is that it's been a huge amount of collaboration, and actually it's probably less fractious than it would be in normal times. Because of some of the external factors that people felt like they can't control. So it's been a case of everyone pulling together.
Are you saying that the food industry has become charitable and embracing?
Charitable is an interesting case. Well, actually, there's been quite a lot of charity, actually. So yes, we have become more charitable, but certainly there's been a sense of a common problem. And I think, you know, on the operational level, I think the levels of collaboration that have gone on have been pretty impressive, and hopefully I'll have a legacy that will see us through the next phase as well. I guess I would challenge your point about, I think the supply chain, and I think also a colleague said it earlier in the conversation, we've held up incredibly well we've kept the nation fed through this time. And yes, there have been some outages on shelf at certain points, primarily during the panic buying phase. Actually, there wasn't any major disruption to the supply chain, and we've coped very successfully. The other thing to say is that during the lockdown period, actually what we've seen is quite a significant simplification of consumption patterns, in that it has been more weekly shop, it has been more people going to the supermarket, planning their meals, cooking at home. The fragmentation is actually was the trends were there before, when you're seeing more out of home consumption and that kind of thing. And I think so, actually it's been a weird sort of period of simplicity rather than fragmentation and fractiousness.
Okay, well, this is a really interesting idea that I'd love to explore. So Sam, as well as this being an enormous problem for the industry, I feel that it has come through incredibly well. So are there exciting positives to gain from how the entire system has dealt with lockdown?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of positives to take away from this. And I think that the idea of sharing a common problem is important. And I think what we have seen is this collaboration between distributors and wholesalers and retailers sharing lorries, trucks, as I call them, sharing, you know, final mile delivery as well. And I think that idea of actually having these industry players who used to be competitors pulling together to share capacity has really helped us through the pandemic. And I think that could
do you think that will sustain? Is that have they discovered a new business model in this, or is it purely crisis management?
Well, I think in all honesty, it's a cost saving initiative as well. So I think it can sustain. I mean, instead of sending half empty lorries, if you can have a full lorry, if you're sharing it with a competitor, then why wouldn't you? So, and the same thing with distribution facilities, you want to make sure that you're sweating your assets. So I think the whole point there is if, as companies begin to realize, well, there's costs to be saved here, that this model can continue.
So Mike, have you seen retailers getting positives from all of this? Have they become more dynamic because of it? Or are they still just in shock mode where they're thinking, what the hell's going to happen next?
What we are seeing when we work with retailers and manufacturers, and what we're hearing from the retail trade, and what we're seeing in general, is a lot more innovation. Things that were said could never be done have been done. The doubling of online.
And are we talking products, supply chain, or
I'm talking about anything? We're seeing innovation across retail formats and retail operations in particular. I'm not particularly close to the supply chain collaboration. I guess you other guests can talk about that. But in terms of happening in store, the move to cashless payments is one example. The innovation in terms of online, how we actually walk around the stores. And then we're now seeing innovation in terms of products coming through the procurement line for the future in terms of simplification. I absolutely agree. That's been a common theme. You know, around 5% rationalization of grocery ranges has happened very quickly. It may not sound that much, but that's many thousands of lines in each retailer. And that was an indication of having to do things different. So the key thing is it speeds up innovation. It's accelerated the direction which all the retailers are going anyway in terms of having to repurpose, particularly some of the larger stores, because online was always going to explode. And also it's led to a much better understanding, I believe, of some of the needs of consumers, which are always just beneath the surface. Things such as provenance, quality, trust, integrity. Those things are starting to come to the surface as we see at the moment. And I think those will be some of the things that will be innovated led as we go forward over the next 6, 9 and probably 12 months.
Yeah. Now, also, growth has been really uneven across the majors, hasn't it? So Iceland grew 23.7%, whereas Tesco grew 12%. Obviously, 12% growth at Tesco has a bigger impact than 23.7% at Iceland. But it's significant, isn't it, that there has been a very different impact with different retailers?
Yes, you mentioned the growth of Tesco. That was Tesco's fastest growth in over a decade. according to the Nielsen Total Tour measure, and they grew market share, which, as I say, hasn't happened for many, many years. I mean, you could say that everyone's been a winner because of the market growth. As I say, been typically market growths have been 5 or 10% now, quite stable for the last few weeks. Iceland have done very well because one of the fastest growing categories has been frozen, as people not only stock up their larders, but refill their freezers. And Iceland also benefited from their food warehouse format, which gave them the ability to have a much bigger range in stores and retail parks. So, but small stores have also done well. The convenience stores, for example, the Co-op, the biggest convenience.
The Co-op's done incredibly well, haven't they?
The Co-op is one of the fastest growing retailers at the moment, over 3,000 stores nationally. And, you know, we've seen spend per visit rise across industry by about 25-30% in recent weeks, and even more than that in small cooperative convenience stores, because a small store is easier for shoppers to go to if they have restricted living.
And this is the localization that you mentioned earlier.
Localization, well, proximity retail. And on one hand, yes, we've seen the return of the big shop, as has been talked about. But also, we've seen further growth in the small shop in terms of Iceland or the Co-op as two different examples. So it's all about meal occasions at the moment, and not necessarily what we used to call shopping missions. You know, we used to talk about pop-up shops and weekly shops. I mean, that's history. We're now talking about meal occasions and different sorts of reasons for business in a store. And of course, a lot of it is done digitally. If we actually think about it, we may not just shop online, but we'll plan our meals and our family meals online before we leave the house. So there's a whole psychology that's different behind this, as well as the type of formats or type of stores that we physically use.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Shane, it appalls me to even bring this up, really, but we've got the impact of Brexit plus COVID-19. It's not the perfect storm. It's the most disastrous combination of problems, I think, that I've ever seen facing the food industry. Does this bring everyone out in a sweat, or would you rather just not think about it?
I think there's a real problem that people aren't thinking about it. I mean, the way that Brexit has been handled over 3 years has left retailers and the supply chain generally in a position where they've been burnt so many times by being told to prepare for one thing and it not being ending up being that they are effectively having to leave it. There's too much of a pressure. There's too much of a focus on, or a need to focus on COVID-19 to really be able to squeeze in thinking about the Brexit scenario. But we are storing up massive problems for our imports and exports of food.
So Sam, do you think that the vast amount of changes and the still evolving nature of all this means that people aren't making long-term decisions? They're not really planning. They're waiting till things settle before they can make any more assumptions about how to run their businesses.
Yeah, I would say the COVID-19 obviously has a huge amount of uncertainty, not just about we're coming out of lockdown, but are we going back into lockdown again? Is there going to be a second wave, et cetera? So you have that uncertainty. And then you have Brexit on the horizon by December 31st, and that amplifies that level of uncertainty. A month ago, no deal was off the table, and now it's back on. And the interesting thing with Brexit is it's just not in the headlines like it was back in December and January because of the COVID-19 crisis. So you have this underlying uncertainty of Brexit in addition to COVID-19. And it's incredibly difficult. And I think what was said earlier is exactly right, is the retailers have to focus on what's in front of their nose at the very moment before they can think about what's going to happen in December or January of 2021.
Okay, so now, Mike, we've got consumer data for the last 3 months, but as you say, it's wildly unpredictable. Nobody really knows what's going to happen. Nobody knew what was going to happen when it did happen. But we've got 3 months of data now. Can we use this data to shape future retail strategy, or is everything still up in the air?
We can certainly use what we're seeing at the moment as a good indicator happens next. What we believe will happen is the current behavior, which is less visits to stores, spending 5%, 10% more than we were pre-COVID, primarily because we don't have an eating out channel at the moment, which probably provides about 30-40% of all the calories that household consumes. That will continue, we believe, through the summer months. The next trigger is going to be around September, October time, when, regrettably, the impact of the end of the furlough schemes kick in. The recession will be much more top of mind, and we do anticipate a big pressure on the consumer. And then in 2021, we have to consider the impact of Brexit. So I think we should be looking, as we would typically do, shopping behavior or change or being reinforced every 12 weeks at this moment in time. That gives a good indication. I've talked a lot about the last 4 and 8 weeks. That was a maelstrom of behavior. But yeah, every quarter, and it does often fit in with the seasonality. So I think there are some learnings, but the next big learning is what happens now between today and the end of August. Will we see the out-of-home food service industry open up? A lot of commentators suggesting that we may lose for the near future 25-30% of the demand in that channel. So long as there is less demand and less ability, that will transfer to the supermarkets, which why I believe we will probably see the current stronger growth continue for the next few months.
Okay, now and let's think about the shift of the industry as well. So there's an acceleration in e-commerce. I mean, lots of new startups are selling, you know, online. Shane, do you think that that this shift means that the supply chain has to respond in a different way when there are new entrants coming into the market?
Well, supply chain is constantly shifting and adapting to the market at the sort of pull, the demand end. I guess let's be very clear that we're talking about the fragmentation difficulties and even the COVID-19 difficulties in supply chain. We've been in the last mile. They've either been in terms of filling up the shelf in the shop, or they've been about getting stuff to people at home through home delivery. And that's where the collaboration, the capacity and innovation has been most acute. So that is where the supply chain is constantly evolving. There's a whole range of sort of vehicle technology and digital capability challenges in that area. The rest of the supply chain, if I'm honest, I think it's working very well. It's a model that's very responsive to cope very well with COVID-19, and you know, continues to need to be invest and continuous improvement. But fundamentally, it's going to be the same job in 10 years as it was.
What do you think is the weakest link of the supply chain that's been laid bare by this crisis?
The consumer?
The damn consumer.
A supply chain business. There was never a problem of lack of food, but we were all panic buying toilet rolls. Yeah. And we couldn't fill up the shelf enough for the demand that was there. It was completely artificial demand. It was entirely herd behavior. And it was manufactured for those reasons. There was no other systemic failure in the supply chain other than that.
I love the way that it twists in that way. Okay, Sam, what about other fundamentals that might change? I mean, could the pandemic herald a new era for onshoring? Has it changed relationships with producers, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of interesting things. I mean, one thing that I have observed is the movement between channels. And I think that's something that we should acknowledge is what we did see when the restaurants and the schools began to close, and you had manufacturers and distributors who were selling into those areas. They were, you know, scrambling to find somewhere to sell their goods. And I think one area that we could be looking at is more flexibility between channels from commercial to retail, where you have flexibility in packaging. So you can go from large oil drums or large batches of butter, and you're able to downsize that packaging to make smaller packaging for retail stores.
Yeah, but flexibility costs, doesn't it?
It absolutely does cost. But if they did have that capacity and they were able to switch over very quickly, what would have been the sales advantages of doing so? So I think you have to look at the trade-offs of the cost of investing in those different channels and the ability to switch between channels. And I think there might be some sales benefits for companies there. And I think the other interesting issue is, I mean, onshoring is something that's talked a lot about in other sectors, in particular. I think about pharmaceuticals, automotive, aerospace, and that has been a big movement at the moment in terms of the onshoring sort of trend. It's more difficult, obviously, in grocery because you have where your raw materials are sourced from, sometimes are linked to a particular country, and that makes that more difficult. But I think where there is an ability to localize manufacturing, then that should definitely be explored just to spread your risk a little bit more. So you have a UK sourcing option in addition to sourcing from Spain or from Italy.
So a question for all three of you, really, and I don't know who wants to answer this, but do you think that the UK food industry needs to plan for this kind of a crisis to happen again, or will we just retreat into our shelves and hope it all blows over and that things will get back to normal? You know, is a pandemic or a major crisis now going to be part of large companies' planning? Mike, could you start with this? Do you see the retailers thinking this might happen again?
I think the learning that will be taken forward is it's happened once, it could probably happen again. The shock that we were expecting was, of course, Brexit, and stockpiling by the consumers was anticipated, and the industry had had two attempts because of the phase negotiations to do some planning ahead of that. But what we've just seen in terms of the pandemic is nothing like what was expected had Brexit happened when it originally supposed to happen. So I think planning for the next crisis is perhaps the wrong interpretation. I think the buzzwords I'm feeling and hearing are simplicity, more flexibility, and dare I say it, less reliance upon global supply chains, and looking at more local supply chains, which particularly is relevant to fresh and chilled foods.
Yeah, Shane, are you seeing that shift, do you think?
I think, well, I guess on your first question about, I think there definitely will be loads of crisis plans that come out in every organisation across the country around pandemics. Whether they'll be needed for another 100 years is a difficult question to answer, but there definitely will be those plans. That's always the way it works with crisis planning. I guess I would challenge a bit the idea of the shift towards local. And actually, some of these sort of interpretations around consumer trends like local sourcing and sort of health consciousness and stuff, I think those trends are all there. I don't think necessarily COVID-19 has done anything other than accelerate them or temporarily make consumers look at them in a different way. And one thing I definitely challenge is that I think that what we've learned from this pandemic is we need to get supplies from a range of different places and not be reliant on one. And relying on domestic production is just as much of a risk as it is relying on one place in the world.
Sam, would you agree with
that? Yeah, I mean, I think that the buzzword now is supply chain resilience, and the idea there with building resilience is having multiple locations to source from. So, like was said by the previous commentator, is if everything is locally sourced, then that doesn't spread your supply chain risk. Everything is still susceptible to changes in government policy, new governments coming in, and that can directly affect your sourcing of food supplies. So really what we should be talking about is a mix between local sourcing, overseas sourcing, but also from multiple countries and multiple suppliers. So it's building redundancies in the supply chain in terms of having a primary supplier and a backup supplier where possible. And in order to do that, you would give a primary supplier maybe 80% of your business and a backup supplier 20%. That backup supplier is located in a different geographical location, and then you can switch your supply when a crisis hits.
Steph, sorry, I'd just like to pick up on that need for more flexibility in multiple supply chains. I do agree with that, because if you look at the food and drink shopping basket going through our supermarkets, around 40% is fresh foods, and a vast proportion of that is imported from Europe. The other 60% is, for the sake of simplicity, ambient, frozen, alcohol, but a lot of that is global supply chain. So what our research is saying is shoppers, more than half of shoppers, would prefer to buy British and local, but that's not always going to be physically possible, because you still can anticipate the shopper will want the imported seasonal tomatoes from the Netherlands before UK tomatoes or Italian tomatoes come on, and other seasonal products from across the world. So what shoppers say what they do isn't often the case. But the fact that half of shoppers would like to buy more British local and 40% of the shopping basket is fresh is something which is has been amplified during the COVID crisis. And as we go into the summer months, we'll see more volatility in that should there be supply challenges, which hopefully there won't be. But again, the consumer is very unpredictable at this moment in time.
It's the infuriating little things, aren't they, those consumers? Okay, now just one last question for all of you then. And that is this one here. If you had 10 million quid to invest in the food industry in the wake of COVID-19 and the changes that it's had on the supply chain and retail and consumers, what would you invest it in? And you know, this could be an altruistic investment, or it could just be a cold, hard profit. Where do you think the growth would be, and where would you put your dosh? Shane, let's start with you.
I think that the place where I would be focusing most of my investment money would be in genuinely shared digital platforms between links and supply chain. That's probably still the biggest barrier to the seamless collaboration that we actually need if we're going to provide sustainable and resilient supply chains for the next generation.
And do you think that would help us if we had the same sort of lockdown situation again, or just profit you really nicely?
Both. I think both. I think resilient supply chains and supply chains where you've got better visibility in all links around availability and be able to plan and collaborate is absolutely the key. And the barriers between everyone holding data in different places is the single biggest impediment to that.
Moving towards the blockchain then, I guess. Okay, Sam, you've got 10 million quid to invest in the food industry that has risen from the ashes of COVID-19. What would you invest it in?
Well, being a supply chain guy, I would have to say logistics capacity and warehousing capacity. I think there's going to be an increasing need to have warehousing facilities near to major centers of demand. And that is going to continue to grow as the move to online continues, where you're going to have the likes of Amazon and Amazon's Fresh service. They're going to be delivering directly to people's homes. And there will be obviously other online challengers getting into those channels. So I think that's where there's going to be a lot of growth is in the warehousing and logistics area for online deliveries.
So real estate. Okay, that's pretty solid stuff. And Mike, your 10 million quid, you've got the insight into retailer and businesses. Where would you put that 10 million?
So without phoning a friend or asking the audience, I would probably invest where I would have invested at the end of 2019 before the COVID crisis kicked off. So I'd be looking to put money into an existing business, probably international business, with operations in retail stores, digital tech platforms, and very importantly, social commerce.
So a well-distributed company. Then,
absolutely. Absolutely. The European version of Alibaba.
Confidence. Excellent. Okay, well, that's all. That's fantastic. I mean, I think we've got to catch up on this one again and find out what the resonance of COVID-19 has been on the whole industry in the next few months. So thank you so much, all of you, for joining us. We look forward to catching up with you again. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast from Food Matters with Mike Watkins, Sam Roscoe, Shane Brennan, and me, Stefan Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to gut microbiome analysis. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.